KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. California would be among the states hardest hit by the tax bill passed by the U.S. Senate early Saturday morning. Coming up on our weekly political roundtable, we look at what's next for the controversial legislation. And we'll get the latest on the Russia investigation in the wake of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn's guilty plea. Here's California Senator Dianne Feinstein yesterday on the Senate Judiciary Committee's probe.
I think what we're beginning to see is the putting together of a case of obstruction of justice.
That's next after this news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Early Saturday, the U.S. Senate narrowly passed a Republican bill to overhaul the tax system. Next, the House and Senate will work to reconcile their two bills. The plan, as passed by the Senate, would cut taxes for top earners and eventually repeal the estate tax. An analysis by the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, cited by the San Francisco Chronicle, found the top 1% of Californians would get an average of $14,000 annual tax cut, but the bottom 60% would on average pay more in federal taxes by 2027. Meanwhile, Michael Flynn's guilty plea continues to reverberate in Washington and across the country. President Trump's former national security advisor now admits he lied to the FBI about his contacts with Russia's ambassador to the United States. The news prompted a weekend presidential tweet storm attacking the Bureau. And joining us to talk about these most recent developments and more this hour, Amanda Becker, we welcome. Congressional correspondent from Reuters, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good to have you. Also, good to have Stephen Rosenthal with us, senior fellow with the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute. He's a tax lawyer and a former legislation counsel with the Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation. And welcome, Stephen Rosenthal.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you. And we'll also say good morning to Kelsey Snell, congressional reporter for National Public Radio. Welcome, Kelsey Snell. Kelsey Snell, do we have you with us?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I didn't hear you. I'm sorry. Let me begin with you, Kelsey, and let's begin by just talking about the likelihood of reconciliation. Mitch McConnell and the leadership in both houses seem to think, throughout the bicameral legislature seem to think that it's a sure thing. Is it?
I believe that they believe that very strongly for good reason. They Republicans really want to get this tax bill passed. This is the one thing that they can walk away from this year saying they've achieved. And they've come very close. We talk a lot about the differences in these two bills, but the similarities are also pretty overwhelming. And the idea of reconciliation is almost a given.
It's also, though, unpopular, seems to be among the citizenry, and there's a lot of concern by deficit hawks about this $1.5 trillion. And I might add, when the bill was presented to Democrats, there were a lot of chicken scratchings, and there was very little time for them to really read what was going on. These things aren't going to play any role in pulling things back?
They certainly will play a role in the discussion, but I don't think that that is going to be enough to prevent them from getting a bill together that they can pass. It's possible that they actually wind up just having to pass what the Senate passed. They have a lot of constraints based on complex Senate budget rules, and they really do want to get this done. So, yes, the deficit hawks are going to be upset, and they continue to be upset. But I think it's important to remember that Republicans truly believe that cutting taxes will grow the economy, that people will take the money that they save by not paying it in a tax bill and invest it, and that companies will reinvest their profits in hiring more people and growing the economy.
There were, however, a great number of legislators and also particularly on the Democratic side who expressed concern about no public hearings.
Sure. That is going to be an ongoing complaint from Democrats. It was technically done through regular order. There were hearings, and the committees of jurisdiction did approve this bill. But there wasn't a lot of time for debate, and there wasn't a lot of time for consideration. And that will certainly come up, but I don't know that you know, carries that much weight for Republicans who, again, really want to get this tax bill passed.
And again, Katie Snell is congressional reporter for Kelsey Snell, for NPR. Amanda Becker is also with us. She's congressional correspondent with Reuters. And I'm wondering, Amanda, about the wisdom that we keep reading, not only from the Democratic side, but from others who have tried to deconstruct this tax bill, that it's going to essentially be a kind of long-term trajectory to try to undo entitlements.
That is the big concern among Democrats, is that, you know, if you add this much money to the deficit in 5 years, in 7 years, then what's going to be said next is, oh, look, we're out of money. We need to start cutting some of these programs. That would be in the future. It's not something that they're talking about, you know, in the next month or two, but that is kind of one of the big concerns voiced by Democrats right now.
They're also expressing some big concerns about just the nature of spending. There's a good deal of concern now about defense spending as opposed to spending for entitlements, and that continues to get into the whole calculus of this, doesn't it?
Yes. They don't want to be kind of in a sequester-type situation with domestic spending as opposed to defense spending. So, you know, all of this stuff, changing the tax code is very complicated. All these estimates about growth are very complicated. When we saw the dynamic score, which a dynamic score takes into account the growth that they're expecting, it's still, the estimate showed that it would still add $1 trillion to the deficit. So this is a real concern on behalf of a lot of lawmakers.
And there's also, I think we need to mention some real concern that these corporate cuts that are going on, or cuts for the rich, are not necessarily offset by what at least is being presented as cuts for the middle class or cuts for people who are down in the lower income brackets. In fact, there was a piece on NPR recently about graduate students getting hit by this.
Mm-hmm. Some of the student provisions differ in the House and Senate bills, and that's one of the things that they're going to have to figure out as they attempt to reconcile these two bills and get it together into one package. The big difference on the individual rates, of course, that the House and Senate are going to need to figure out is that the Senate rates are temporary for individuals, and that's why you see, as you mentioned at the beginning, the bottom 60% on average paying more by 2027. That's because their taxes are going to revert back to what they are right now, their tax rates. All of these rates suggested in the Senate plan, these cuts for individuals, are temporary.
And let me go to Stephen Rosenthal, who, again, is with the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute and is a lawyer covering taxation issues. Steve, I'm just wondering about what is being essentially pictured as a tax bill. It's called tax reform, but it's really a tax bill, particularly harsh on blue states and urban areas, keeping the red states and the rich a lot better off.
Well, I think that's right, principally because of the repeal of the deduction for state and local income taxes. I think the Senate and House have agreed to a small deduction, preserve a small deduction for property taxes up to $10,000. But that's a huge revenue raiser for the bill. And those high taxes, state and local taxes, are principally in blue states, and they are funding, in effect, the huge corporate tax cuts and the past due tax cuts.
And New York, New Jersey, and California are particularly going to be hit hard by this, right?
Yes, in my home state of Maryland, I keep an eye on this provision.
Okay, well, you got to keep an eye on it for good personal reasons, I presume. But who else is being hurt by this bill?
Well, my own view is the principal loser is future generations. I think Kelsey and Amanda flagged the deficit issue. We have a $20 trillion debt now. This bill will lose at least $1.5 trillion if the supply-side stuff works, then maybe it drops to $1 trillion. But we're heading in the wrong direction, and eventually someone will have to pick up that bill. These are basically tax cuts for everyone. It turns out there are very, very large tax cuts for corporations and rich guys, and very small tax cuts for middle class and low income. But eventually the large deficit will need to be repaid, and that's future generations that lose.
And down the line, we're talking about Medicare, Social Security, welfare, and also, I think, isn't it pretty much a common notion that the elderly and the working poor are going to be hit by this hard?
I think so. They benefit disproportionately from social services, justifiably so. One interesting winner that I've written about is foreign investors. Because if you look to the big winners of this bill, it's multinational corporations. And I've done a lot of work recently to demonstrate that 35% of that stock is held by foreign investors, and they get a windfall from investments they've already made in our U.S. corporations when after-tax profits will drop. And my estimate is that windfall could be $50, $70 billion a year, a very large amount that we'll never be able to get back when we're facing Social Security and Medicare shortfalls. They don't care about making up the difference in those areas.
Yeah, again, we're talking about the future. We're not talking about anything that's imminent here, but certainly that may be down the line. Let me go back, if I may, to Kelsey Snell, who is, again, congressional reporter for National Public Radio. And let's first of all hear a cut from California Senator Dianne Feinstein. All right, well, okay, I want to hear that in a moment. But what I'm getting at here is Senator Feinstein has essentially said, Kelsey, that she's going to move toward and we should move toward obstruction of justice charges against the president. This was after she had spoken somewhat conciliatory, and she is up for reelection. But there was a item on Axios which has caught a lot of attention, and I want to get your take on it, that came about by President Trump's personal lawyer, John Dowd, who said there's an legal argument for the president not being able to be charged with obstruction of justice because Article 2 of the Constitution and his being the chief legal officer precludes that.
Well, I think it's important to think about this also from the political side of things, that part of this is that Democrats are going to push for this, and they don't really have control over whether or not these charges happen. This is going to be a political conversation for them. And yes, it may be beneficial for them to talk about it in this way. But most of them don't have the legal background to, you know, to determine that question there.
Well, we're still talking about Flynn's guilty plea because he is cooperating with the special prosecutor. And what that can lead to, we don't know. But we had President Trump tweeting just over the weekend that the FBI is in disarray and, again, causing a whole hornet's nest of response from people like James Comey and even Eric Holder, the former attorney general. What do you suppose the president is? We're always trying to read the president's mind here, but what do you expect he's trying to do with respect to Congress?
That is, I agree. It's very difficult to read the president's mind when it comes to his tweets. Honestly, even people who are close to him have a hard time reading the president's mind when it comes to these tweets. I will say, though, that it's not particularly helpful from the congressional perspective to have the president out there making these kinds of statements. It's very difficult for them to respond. His statements on Twitter are not directives. They can't. It's very complicated for Congress, essentially, and I think it may be a fool's errand to attempt to determine what the president is trying to direct people to say here.
Well, it was a tweet that also caused another storm over the weekend that was allegedly initially from President Trump, though, again, his lawyer, John Dowd, said he sent the tweet, which not only went back to or alluded to the fact of the firing of James Comey, the former head of the FBI, but also said that at the time it seemed to express the notion that President Trump was aware of lying about that.
Yeah, and there's a lot of questions about when he drafted this tweet, and the timing of this could prove to be a very big and important question over the next week or so.
Well, let me go to another big question that's looming with you, Amanda Becker, if I may. And even over the weekend, we get lots of questions that continue to loom. But we've got Devin Nunes now, who's talking about the Justice Department stonewalling and actually threatening contempt of court citations and the rest of it. Can you set for our listeners what's going on here?
I think part of what's going on here is that the White House thought that this entire probe and investigation would be over by the end of the year, and they've been saying that it would be over by the end of the year. We are clearly into December. It seems like it's full speed ahead. We have the first guilty plea. So what you're seeing is a political response to that. People had said this would be over. It's clearly continuing. And back to John Dowd for a minute, the lawyer, he actually attributes that tweet to just a simple wording mistake because Twitter only allows you so many characters. He told my colleagues in an interview this weekend, the mistake was that I should have put lying to the FBI in a separate line referencing his plea. Instead, I put it together and I made you guys all go crazy. A tweet is shorthand. So the lawyer saying not only did he write that tweet for Trump, he messed up on the tweet. And the way in which he messed up was he just, you know, mush those two things together, that they knew that Flynn, A, lied to the vice president, and B, lied to the FBI. And now he's saying, the president didn't know he lied to the FBI until he was charged on Friday.
Could his lawyer be falling on a sword for his client here? I mean, this is the first time we know of, on record at least, that someone has tweeted for the president.
We will never know. I mean, attorney-client privilege protects all of their communications between the two of them. There's no way to even subpoena that conversation or get a record of that conversation. That's all privileged between the two of them.
And speaking of privileges, what about KT McFarland saying that Russia threw the election for Trump? I mean, again, this seems to be a misstatement, according to McFarland, but it's out there.
It is out there. And sometimes you look at these statements and you don't know why they're saying them, if it's a strategic statement, if it was something that was said off the cuff, because in this entire process, over and over again, people in the administration or linked to the administration say things that you wouldn't expect them to say. And sometimes it comes to light weeks or months later why they may have said that, but we don't immediately know all the time.
Again, Amanda Becker, congressional correspondent for Reuters, and Steve Rosenthal is also with a senior fellow for the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Steve, can you give us sort of an outline from your perspective about the likelihood of a government shutdown? I know this gets into congressional politics, but there's going to be at least an attempt to put forward a two-week spending measure that would essentially be a stoppage. How close are we to a shutdown as you see it?
Well, we don't shut down the government very often. And I think there are a large number of Republicans who believe that at least a two-week extension could shift things to January and allow them more negotiating leverage. By contrast, you might expect the Democrats actually to think differently about that. The Democrats have just been shut out of any participation in the tax bill, and so perhaps the Democrats will try to take a stand now to stake out a tougher line. We'll see. There also are a couple of promises as part of the tax bill for, say, Flake. Senators Flake from Arizona wanted some commitment to DACA. Senator Collins wanted some commitment that when the Obamacare mandate was going to be repealed as part of the Senate tax bill, that it would be addressed subsequently. So those pieces of the puzzle might yet come up in the context of this two-week shutdown, which could complicate both the extension bill as well as tax negotiations.
Well, they need, the GOP needs Democratic votes, but there's also, again, in this, the whole slippery slope of whether money should go to defense or non-defense spending, isn't there?
I can take that. Yeah, there is a conversation about that. I think that that's going to be a really big part of this. So Democrats have not yet agreed to support a two-week CR. CR, which is the short-term spending bill. In part, that's because they want Republicans to commit to some of these bigger picture spending issues before they'll show up and deliver the votes. Democrats are needed to get this bill passed. Republicans have not been able to demonstrate that they can pass a spending bill in the House alone. They technically have enough Republicans to do that, but they have never been able to deliver the votes to get something passed. And it's also essential in the Senate to have Democrats vote for it. So they have a lot of leverage here. The problem is that nobody really knows how the president will intervene or what the president will say. They look like they were traveling towards an agreement last week, but when the president tweeted that he didn't see a deal in sight, Democrats pulled out of the conversation. They're hoping to get back to the table today and over the next couple of days and work something out, but there is a big question mark about where things will go from here.
Well, I remember when President Trump sat down with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and was supposedly moving towards some kind of crossing the aisle, but nothing came of it. In fact, there was, if anything, a lot of anger expressed from both sides. I'm just wondering, and Kelsey, I'd like your thoughts on this, whether perhaps the Democrats are trying to put up a united front just to block President Trump the way the Republicans did against them.
Democrats say that they are not trying to do that. It's important to remember that Democrats don't want to be held responsible for a shutdown either. Nobody wants to be held responsible for a shutdown. And Democrats enjoy being the grown-ups in the room. And this, if they were to get into a fight with a president like this, that would take away their ability to say that we're the ones that you can rely on to keep the government open.
Let me bring up one other thing before I bring our callers into this and our listeners. In fact, let me give out the number now because you may want to join us. We're talking largely about developments that have occurred over the weekend, not only with respect to the Mike Flynn agreement that was made, that is actually an indictment that's been passed forward by the Mueller investigative team, but also talking about the implications recently of some tweets by the president and also about the tax bill. If you have something you'd like to add to this conversation, we do want to hear from you. And if you have questions or comments, we want to hear from you generally. You can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. The number is available to you whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Again, please join us now at 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website and post questions or comments there, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, talking with Kelsey Snell of NPR and Amanda Becker of Reuters and Steve Rosenthal of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. And let me go back, if I may, just for a moment to you, Amanda Becker, just to get your read on what else is very much prominent in the news now, and that is the endorsement. Not even de facto, really, an endorsement today of Roy Moore. It came from President Trump.
Yes, it sure does seem like a de facto endorsement. He phrased it this way as to the Roy Moore race. Democrats' refusal to give us one vote for massive tax cuts is why we need Republican Roy Moore to win in Alabama. So this election is next week. It's somewhat unclear at this point how fast the winner of that race would be seated. I honestly think that the reconciliation process for this tax bill could move very quickly, so it might not be an issue, and they could be entirely done with it by the time that that person is seated in the Senate. But they're worried about losing, you know, what happens if they lose one more Republican. Now, that still leaves them with 52 or 51 Republicans, and the only one to vote against it on Friday was Senator Bob Corker. So they could still pass that with the vice president acting to break the tie. But it just gets all the more complicated when you start losing votes. The president said, looking ahead to immigration, he's saying that means you can't rely on Democrats to work with them on that. I think that's an entirely different issue that's likely to get a little bit more cooperation if they take up a DACA fix or something like that. But you did see Trump weighing in on the Moore race. And even some congressional leaders are changing the language and the way they talk about it. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had previously said he believed Moore's accusers. They seemed legitimate. And he was among a series of Senate and House leaders that urged him to drop out of the race. Obviously, Moore has not done that. And McConnell said over the weekend that it's up to Alabama voters to decide whether they're going to send Moore to Congress.
You mentioned DACA. Isn't DACA a part of the deal that was worked out here to get at least one or two votes more?
It's very wobbly as to what they actually agreed on.
I thought Jeff Flake wanted that in the bill.
Yes, he did. And he put out a statement because he was one of the holdouts over the deficit impact of this. He's a deficit hawk, along with Corker. And he put out a statement on Friday saying, I'm going to vote for this. I've worked out something on business expensing, even though the deficit won't be completely addressed. And also, I've been assured that, you know, I'm going to have a role in getting a DACA fix together. About 2 minutes after we got that statement, I saw Mark Short, which is the legislative director on the Hill from the White House. We asked him about it. He said, you know, there's no hard and fast deal. We told him he could be a part of that conversation. And then you saw Senator Cornyn a little bit after that saying, you know, we haven't discussed actual policy, but certainly Senator Flake will have a seat at the table. He's a senator, and all senators who want to participate will have a seat at the table.
All right, we're coming up on the break. When we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners. Stay tuned. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is our Monday morning political news roundup, and we're discussing recent political developments, including next steps in tax overhaul. And Amanda Becker is with us from Reuters, and Kelsey Snell from NPR, and Steve Rosenthal, who's with the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute. And Steve, let me read a couple of, a question and a comment. First, a comment on taxes. A listener says, this is not a tax plan. This is a heist against the American people by the Republicans, transferring massive wealth and tax cuts to their paymasters, billionaires, Wall Street operatives, and multinational corporations. But here's Frank, who wants to know, has any tax cut in the recent past resulted in kickstarting the economy, as the Republicans contend? Steve Rosenthal?
I don't think so. I think there's very little evidence that supply-side and trickle-down theories work. If you look back to the last couple of big tax, pieces of tax legislation, you had the Bush number two big tax cuts in 2001, which eventually expired. They didn't seem to do much good. By the time Bush number two left office, our country was in huge debt and deficits, and our regulatory and financial system was spinning out of control. If you go back a prior decade, when I was working on Capitol Hill, I worked on the budget reconciliation of 93, in which Secretary Rubin persuaded President Clinton to raise taxes in order to bring down interest rates. And so President Clinton proposed a very tough revenue bill that didn't get a single Republican vote in either the House or the Senate. There were, on the House side, Democrats who lost their seats voting to advance and only made it through by one vote on each side of the Capitol. But then if you recall, despite the predictions of complete collapse and disaster, our country was launched on prosperity and surpluses. So when Bush number two finally came into office, he started with a surplus.
Let me bring our callers into this. And William has a question about taxes. William, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I am wondering, how permanent are these tax cuts? Why couldn't they be changed by a Democratic Congress in 2 years?
Steve Rosenthal, you want to go to that too?
Well, sure, they could be changed. One of the interesting phenomena that I think Amanda noted was all of the corporate tax cuts are permanent, and the individual tax cuts are scheduled to expire in 2025. The theory was that it was better to expire the individual tax cuts because future Congresses would be under more pressure to extend them, and so that's why those were left to expire. But having said that, one of the interesting things, if you look to the UK as a model, it turns out that just on the last round, the Labour Party won on a campaign of increasing corporate tax rates after earlier reductions in corporate, aggressive reductions in UK corporate taxes. We may be headed to something similar as well. So future Congresses could, in fact, unwind these tax cuts, although there will be a lot of revenue lost in the meantime. And at least when the President Trump is in office, he may insist that the Congress override a veto, which could be hard to do in the next 3 years.
And let me thank William for his call and go right to more of your calls. Let me go next to Dean. Dean, join us.
Yeah, hi, good morning, Michael. My question was, if President Trump can back away from his tweet that was supposedly written by his attorney, then does he also have the ability to back away from any speech he's written because he wasn't the author of those words?
Kelsey Snell?
I suppose. The president is, he has often backed away from things that he's said and has said that he didn't say things that are on the record. It wouldn't be outside the realm of possibility with this president.
But we have had another wrinkle in terms of the Access Hollywood tape, and you may want to comment on that, Amanda, Amanda Becker. Billy Bush has said, yeah, it's legitimate. It was the president's voice, because he tried to intimate that it may not have been his voice.
Yes. So this is a situation in which he's not only saying that something that he said was, not what he would have said or written by someone else, he's actually saying that it's not his voice on a tape that he originally, kind of gave a half apology for when it first came out. And, there was no quibbles about whether it was him.
And admitted that it was him. He said, this is locker room talk and I'm sorry and
yeah.
I apologize. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, he didn't have any argument as to the fact that it was not him until the past couple weeks. And now he's saying that, oh, well, that may not even be my voice. I doubt that's my voice. And you have now Billy Bush over the weekend saying, that was definitely President Trump.
Let's bring on more of your calls. Let's go next to Pat. Pat, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Matt, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So we're in 1982 all over again. Those of us who have been paying attention back when Buckminster Fuller talked about the Grunch, which was gross universal cash heist that happened shortly after Ronald Reagan was elected president, and we went through exactly the same pattern that we're going through now. Decimation of the EPA, total reworking of the financial structure of the country that send more money racing to the top while indeed it trickles down on people's heads. And it's so infuriating for those of us who have been here before to see how the Democratic Party once again has no control over the narrative whatsoever. And it's so sad to see that they're not latching on, and our liberal so-called media is not latching on to these real stories about children losing their health insurance and what's happened in the poverty levels. Go to Terre Haute, Indiana, and see the boarded up homes with the homeless people living outside of them. The stories aren't being told by the Democrats in a way that will gain the empathy and compassion that American people need to feel in order to throw these thieves out of office.
Pat, let your comments stand, and I thank you for them. I want to actually bring up something else that I want in the mix here. And Amanda Becker, let me go to you on this. Peter Stroke, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, STRZOK, was removed over the weekend from the Russia probe for anti-Trump texts. And I bring that up because he was also very centrally involved working with the FBI on Hillary Clinton's email server.
Yes, this is
He was removed in the summer. Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and news broke of this over the weekend that two members of the FBI team had exchanged texts with one another that were anti-Trump. Of course, this is what the president immediately seized on in his tweet storm that you mentioned when we opened the show, criticizing the FBI. And now you've seen, FBI directors, former members of the FBI kind of defending it. It's very difficult for morale in these agencies when the president is criticizing you for doing your job. A lot of these are career people. They are there from administration to administration. They, for the most part, keep their thoughts about these administrations to themselves. So the fact that this news about this one person has come up and the president has seized on that to not only, cast this probe as somehow make it seem more illegitimate, and then to make gross generalizations about the FBI, that's really rough for people involved in these agencies.
Yeah, and you have to ask not only the people in the agencies in terms of lowering their morale, but Kelsey Snell, what about congressional people who have respect for and maybe even idealize the FBI? From their perspective, this great institution.
Yeah, you often hear members of Congress defending the FBI in these types of situations. It's not the first time that we've seen the president or this administration say things negative about parts of the government. And I think Congress that's one of the places where members of Congress have been fairly comfortable pushing back against the president is standing up for individual institutions in the government like the FBI. We saw some of this happen right around when all of the Comey stuff was happening. We saw a lot of members of Congress coming out and saying that, that they respect the work that is done at the professional level in the government.
But at this point, is it safe to say that the president really has, except for a few, maybe like John McCain and Bob Corker, total support from his party, virtually a unanimous support from his party? And if that is indeed the case, after this victory, which we're saying is very likely in terms of tax bill, would it be more perhaps possible for some of them to fall away from their support for the president? Your thoughts on that, Kelsey?
It's possible. I think that it's a complicated relationship between Trump and a lot of Republicans. I think that it's not quite fair to say that he has universal support from them. I think it's on an issue-to-issue basis, and that it is difficult for members of Congress to criticize the president of their own party. But you do see it happen from time to time, and I think people shouldn't be surprised if that does happen. Though, again, the big motivation for a lot of Republicans in supporting Trump was that he was going to be and will still be a Republican president who will sign legislation that they pass that fits into their ideology. And so as long as he continues to do that and signals that he will sign the legislation that they want to pass, they will likely support him.
Kelsey Snell again is congressional reporter for National Public Radio. I'm going to read a comment here from Rick, who says, why does the national media always talk about how the wealthy are getting the biggest benefit without mentioning that these same wealthy taxpayers pay the vast majority of the taxes? Let me go to another caller, and that's you, Mo. You're on. Morning.
Good morning, Michael. I was wondering what your guests thought the impact of the elimination of the state and local income tax deduction and the reduction in the mortgage deduction would have, particularly in the Bay Area, but California in general.
Yeah, thank you for that. Can you help us here, Steve Rosenthal?
Sure. The elimination of the state and local income tax deduction effectively makes state and local taxes higher. In Maryland, where I live, effectively the taxes I paid to Maryland will be twice as expensive because I can't deduct them on my federal tax return. That puts a lot of pressure on the higher tax states like California or like Maryland to continue to provide the services that their residents need. And sometimes those services are in the form of, you know, largely Medicaid, public education, roads, things of that sort. And to increase the tax, effective tax, by denying a deduction will put a lot of pressure on the legislatures to continue to be able to spend for those programs. One of the curiosities in my mind is it's fashioned the elimination of the state and local tax as a loophole for the rich, say. But if you actually look at the other side of the budget as to where the states, California and Maryland, spend their money, it is on Medicaid, public education, roads, things that you'd view as of broader public benefit and creating positive externalities in our society. I pay a lot of taxes in Maryland, but I don't begrudge that. Now, if you double my taxes, maybe I'll start to begrudge that.
Let me go to another caller here, and that's you, James. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering if somebody could comment on where exactly does what party give to get sort of compromise back on the table? Like, we mentioned earlier that the Democrats are trying to be the adult in the room, but when do we see on potentially what specific topic, a senator willing to base their seat on bringing compromise back on the table by insisting that a bill be bipartisan?
Yeah, can I get you on this, Amanda Becker?
Sure.
Thank you for the call.
It's not going to be on taxes for a couple reasons. And, you know, then we can talk about the future. But on taxes, the math is different for this. In the Senate, the Republicans do not need the Democrats. They just flat out don't need them because they can pass this with a bare majority vote and not the 60 votes they normally need to pass legislation. So there is no incentive from the get-go on taxes for them to reach across the aisle. Now, looking forward on other pieces of legislation, they will need more votes, and they won't have enough Republicans to get those votes. So it may be more likely, on budget deals, on immigration, that they will have to work together a little bit more. But also, Congress has become very divided. They're very divided on most things. Most processes are very partisan at this point. And, you know, even going back to taxes, including something like an Obamacare repeal in a different piece of legislation, that repeal of the individual mandate, is anathema to Democrats and just automatically means they're not going to work with you on something. So I do think there's a very big divide right now. We will not see that divide bridged in this tax process. Maybe as other, you know, pieces of legislation unfold over the next year or two when there's an incentive because they need those votes from across the aisle.
Let me thank the caller and remind you that you can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And here's a website comment. And you may recall we were talking before about Trump attorney John Dowd quoted as saying, and here's the quote, "The president cannot obstruct justice because he is the chief law enforcement officer and has every right to express his view of any case." And Rhonda said, "Someone is saying the president can't be charged with obstruction of justice. Whatever happened to the Supreme Court?" Kelsey Snell, where do congressional representatives come into this, or where do the Democratic voices come into this, or do they come into this, really?
Into the conversation about obstruction of justice?
Well, look, there are congressional investigations that are going on, but in response to something that may be indeed under the aegis more of the Supreme Court. We've got all of President Trump, some people say, doesn't necessarily understand that we have division of branches of government and check and balances. But the reality here is that congressional representatives are going to have to deal with this on their investigative committees, are dealing with this perhaps as we speak.
Democrats are quite involved at the Senate level. The House investigation is maybe proceeding in a more partisan way. But you'll notice that Senator Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, has been very involved and very vocal in all of this. And he seems to be working fairly closely with Senator Richard Burr, who is the Republican leading the investigation in the Senate. So I think that both parties are playing a fairly strong role, at least in the Senate. The House is very different, and I think that Democrats in the House are, particularly Congressman Adam Schiff from California, are very frustrated that they've been more or less locked out of the opportunity to press witnesses the way that they would like to. But I think that they also went into this knowing that it was going to be a far more partisan exercise.
More of your calls. Let me go next to you, Carol. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. I'm very concerned that the medical deduction is only in the Senate plan for older folks like I who pay high prices, especially for cancer survivor and other problems. Those deductions allow me to have great follow-up. If you take away that deduction, you really take away my future health-wise. And I don't trust the Republicans. I think I hear nothing on the radio that says, that talks about the medical deduction. It's all about families, not anything for millions of older people in this country.
Thank you, Carol, for bringing that up. Let me go again to you, Steve Rosenthal, if I may.
Sure. The House bill repeals outright the deduction for medical expenses in excess of 10% of your income. The Senate bill, at the insistence of Senator Collins for her vote, actually extends a year before the repeal takes effect and lowers, actually, the threshold to 7.5% for that year. I don't know the calculus between the House and Senate, which will likely emerge. There is a chance that we'll at least get some relief for a little bit. But I think the caller's absolutely right. This is a tax bill that rewards disproportionately large corporations and rich guys, and strips away a lot of individual deductions, not just from the elderly, but on the health side, the notion of losing a lot of deductions for education, the exclusion for the tuition waivers from income, which will really hit graduate students harshly. This is a social engineering bill, and I think the social engineering at the moment is tilted towards corporations and higher income, basically on a trickle-down theory that eventually workers will benefit.
Let me go to more of our calls. Thank the caller that we just spoke with and go to you, Gabe. Gabe, you're on.
Hi, I had a question regarding President Trump's most recent tweet and then, I guess, mea culpa with his lawyer. Wouldn't there be a way to investigate the metadata related to that Twitter feed and determine which phone it came from and whether or not that phone was actually in possession of President Trump or whether it was outside of the White House when the tweet was made?
Well, that's an interesting question. We need somebody more IT, I think, to answer that question. Or I don't know if any of our panelists want to tackle it, but I think what he says is plausible. Any thoughts from
anyone? It's certainly plausible, and I'm not a technology expert, but even if you determine which phone it was sent from, if Trump says it was composed by his attorney, you know, the person who wrote the tweet isn't necessarily the person who sent the tweet. So then I think you get into an added layer of trying to determine, you know, exactly how that played out.
And let me thank the caller. And I want to ask you, if I may, another question, Amanda Becker, about whether we're going to see possibly an erosion of support from people like Susan Collins of Maine if these side deals they cut are not in the House bill. I mean, she got guarantees about passing legislation on health care premiums, for example.
Yes. And back to the caller who had concerns about the medical expenses deduction. Senator Collins said over this weekend, I need to see what comes out of this conference committee before I say whether I'm going to, you know, support it or not. They have to vote again to accept what comes out of this conference committee. And, you know, that medical expenses deduction was preserved in the Senate bill at Senator Collins' insistence. She also said she agreed to eventually support this on Friday because she was promised that there will be some votes over the next few weeks on, you know, essentially reinforcing parts of the healthcare system because she's concerned about it collapsing. now that they've included the repeal of the individual mandate in the tax bill. So this is not a done deal. And some of these senators, especially on the Senate side, that had insisted on certain things in order to support it on Friday, I would, you know, if you're concerned about various provisions, be watching those people closely over the next few weeks, seeing what's in the final package that comes out from the conference committee, and then watching to see where these lawmakers, you know, might have some issues with that.
Well, a question, Kelsey Snell, from a listener named Cindy, who wants to know about the impact on small businesses. I've heard they're going to lose deductions, she writes. And actually, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin was very much putting forward the idea that small businesses, that's his background, were going to suffer. And that's why he was one of those senators who was opposed.
Well, Senator Johnson actually got some changes put into the bill at the last minute that created a larger deduction for small businesses.
Right.
And we should be clear that it's certain small businesses that file their taxes on the individual side of the tax code. And it's not actually all small businesses. It's all businesses that decide to file their taxes on the individual side of the tax code. And those businesses did get more generous benefits at the end of the day.
So the same question to you, if I may, Kelsey. I mean, are we going to see possibly an erosion of support from those who made deals if they don't really see this being followed through on?
It's possible. But as I think I mentioned earlier, it is possible that what ends up coming out of the conference committee is essentially the Senate bill, because House Republicans understand, as much as they like to complain about the Senate, that's a longstanding tradition of the House complaining about the Senate and the Senate complaining about the House. But at the end of the day, Senate budget rules rule the world in this debate. And if they want a tax bill passed, the House may just have to accept what already went through in the Senate and move on. And if that's the case, then it's entirely plausible that many of these side deals will work themselves out over time, maybe not on the schedule that these senators would like. But it's worth keeping in mind that that is an outcome that's possible.
Steve Rosenthal, if I go back to you, I'm looking at a listener who wants to know whether you can discuss other items included in the tax bills, like offering tax breaks for college for the unborn.
Well, there are a couple of so-so issues that were advanced on the health bill and that you don't find in the Senate bill. One was to be able to identify the unborn as beneficiaries for a 529 plan. That was passed by the House of Representatives, not passed in the Senate. It's unclear whether it was not passed because of a procedural rule known as the Byrd rule, or whether there was just too much silliness or frivolity to the measure for the Senate. And so that may yet have to be resolved in conference. Another social measure that was passed by the House and not passed by the Senate was to allow churches to campaign politically. Since 1965, what is known as the Johnson Amendment, when he was then majority leader of the U.S. Senate, in order to be tax-exempt and to accept tax-exempt contributions, churches and other so-called 501c3s are prohibited from intervening in political campaigns. That has irritated many certain elements of the religious factions. I think mainstream churches think that the separation is warranted, but there's been a lot of interest, especially on sort of the right side of the religious end, for more active engagement. And so, again, the House wanted to liberalize those rules to allow churches to engage more actively.
Yeah, I brought this up in a previous discussion of the tax bill and some of the things that are in there that may not have come to people's attentions, which brings me also, Steve Rosenthal, if I go to you on this, what about the individual mandate and the ACA?
Well, oddly enough, yes, so the House did not have anything about the individual mandate that requires individuals to have Obamacare or pay a penalty. But the Senate did. They, in effect, repealed the mandate by making the penalty zero. And you might think, well, if the penalty is zero, doesn't the government lose revenue? And isn't that, you know, perhaps a difficult choice in this plan that's been carefully negotiated for every penny? It turns out that the revenue actually goes up because fewer of the poor and lower income categories will sign up for Obamacare and receive subsidies. And so if there's no penalty in place, actually acting against their own interest because the subsidies are of value to them. And so that savings in government funding of future Obamacare subsidies is now being applied to some of the business tax cuts to keep them as big as they are. And so that's another social measure. I think that the House will welcome this provision. I would have thought that some of the senators who voted against repealing Obamacare just a few months ago might have staked out a tougher stance on the repeal of the mandate. But they didn't. The mandate is unpopular. People don't like to have to pay penalties for not doing something. Of course, in order to have a healthcare system work and to make sure that you have a health pool that represents both healthy and sick, you need to require everyone to participate.
Steve,
and that's
Roosevelt,
what the mandate was designed to do.
Steve Roosevelt, again, is a tax lawyer and former legislative counsel with the Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation. And we're going to have to wrap this up, but as we look ahead, maybe we'll go back to you, Kelsey Snell. Some thoughts?
I mean, yeah, I think that this is going to be an interesting debate going forward. And watching the way that Republicans talk about this tax bill, and particularly how they talk about taxes in relation to plans that they may have for cutting spending and for reining in entitlement programs, I think is something that people are going to need to be watching.
Well, we will continue to watch on your behalf as well as on behalf of what we do here daily. And I thank those who joined us for this hour. Again, Kelsey Snell is congressional reporter for NPR. Steve Rosenthal, senior fellow with the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute. And Amanda Becker is congressional correspondent for Reuters. Thank you to our guests. Thank you to our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. And when we return, we're going to be talking with Haroon Mogal, who has written a book really about being a Muslim in America. It's called How to Be a Muslim, an American Story. Stay tuned for that. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.